All right, this is April the 15th, 2010. This is Alicia Martin, and I better change this a little bit. I am here with Ike Pinkston, and we're doing interviews for the Military Treasures exhibit with the Kentucky Historical Society and also with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. Hi, Ike.
Hello.
How I like to start off with these is just so you can give us a little background information on yourself. So take it away, just a little bit.
Specifically about the military?
Specifically or? In this case, why don't you start off with that?
So. Okay, that'll work. I guess I have to back up a little farther than that. What generated my interest in aviation? When I was 6 years old, I lived down in Glasgow, Kentucky, and my dad worked full-time for the National Guard, and there was an old gentleman named William Berry, Bill Berry, who just passed away this past year. And he later was a mechanic working full-time for the Guard here in Frankfort with the Kentucky National Guard. And Bill took me in a little airplane, a little two-seater tandem-seat airplane, an airplane ride, just three or four times around the airfield and a few takeoffs and landings. And from that point on in my life, I knew that aviation was going to play an instrumental role in what I did. I didn't know exactly how, but I knew I loved it. And my brother could attest that I spent a lot of time building model airplanes. Our room was just covered with them hanging from the ceiling because I'd put them together and put them in dives and climbs and turns and hang them by wire from the ceiling. So anyway, fast forward till I was in high school when I was 17 years old. I joined the National Guard in February of 1971. And then when I graduated in June, and I believe it was either June the 2nd or June the 3rd, I walked across the stage there at Franklin County and got my diploma at 10 o'clock, about 10 o'clock at night's when I actually got mine, and 10 o'clock the next morning I was on a jet going to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I went through my basic training there, and then between basic and AIT, which is advanced individual training, I was scheduled to go and become a helicopter mechanic. Between those two periods, I had about a week and a half off, and I came back to Kentucky. And I had already made up my mind I wanted to fly helicopters, not just work on them. So I went and took the officer candidate test, and I went down to Fort Knox and took the flight aptitude scholastic test after I had asked, at the time, he was Captain David Fleming, who was the facility commander at the Boone Center here for many years, really a great guy. But I had mentioned to my dad, as I said earlier, who worked full-time for the Guard, that I wanted to do this flight school thing. He said, well, Dave Fleming's the guy you got to talk to. So I went and talked to him. He scheduled me to get my OCS test and my flight aptitude scholastic test between basic and AIT. I took those things, passed them. Also got my class one flight physical. And they started the process for me, my application for going to flight school at that time. And I'm not sure, I may have still been 17 when I did that. Then went through AIT, learned about working on helicopters, and came back from there. And I had a date for February of 72 to attend flight school. So between coming back from the basic training and February, I worked temporary for the National Guard as the shop clerk at the Boone Center at the aviation facility, which was great because it got me around the aircraft and I got a little exposure and learned a little about forms and records, and worked for a great old guy who was a World War II vet, Kelly McGarry. So then in 1972, February of 72, I went to flight school at Fort Walters, Texas. I'm one of the last guys to ever attend the primary training there at Fort Walters. Shortly after I left, it closed and they moved the entire operation to Fort Rucker. After you did 4 months of primary training, four and a half, at Fort Walters you went to Fort Rucker for advanced training, where you went through basic instruments and intermediate instrument training. And what's interesting about my career also is my class was the first class in Army Aviation where every pilot got a standard instrument ticket. prior to that, they taught you just enough to survive if you accidentally got in the clouds, and they picked a handful of the aviators to actually get their standard instrument ticket to be allowed to fly. Helicopters are pretty unstable, and at that time, flying them in the clouds was kind of a new thing. So one of the interesting things, too, is the guy that taught me to fly was his name was Helterbrand, and he was a Korean War pilot, helicopter pilot, and was a late 40s pilot when he first got into helicopters. And so he was one of the very earliest pioneers of helicopter aviation. And he was my instructor there at Fort Walters. Really a great guy and a really great pilot. And anyway, I graduated in November of 1972 from the United States Army Helicopter Training Program there at Fort Rucker. Came back to the Kentucky Guard where I was asked to work full-time in the recruiting program because I was a young fella. I just barely 2 months into being 19 years old when I graduated. And it's kind of unique to be that age and somebody give you $1 million helicopter. They tell you to go have fun. So that was pretty cool. But I worked full-time in the recruiting program, traveling across the state, visiting high schools and festivals all across the state, doing static displays and recruiting for the National Guard. Yeah, it was really pretty interesting being that age and going to high schools and visiting with people and putting on a little slideshow on career days and what have you when some of the kids there were older than me. And that was kind of a unique draw for the Kentucky Guard. Worked for a wonderful gentleman named Colonel Alfaro, who was in charge of the recruiting program at that time. From there, I just, by luck of the draw, had a few things happen that were really, really great career enhancers. One of my friends was selected to go to the OH-58 instructor pilot course and at the last minute couldn't go. And Colonel Fleming called me, and I might have been 21 by then, and asked me to fill in since he had this slot he needed to fill quickly. And I did that, and then later went to the Army's test pilot course. I think that was about 1974. Then went to the Army's Warrant Officer Advanced course at Fort Rucker, and when I completed that, I took a 3-year tour of active duty and flew medevac helicopters down at Fort Stewart, Georgia, with the 498th Medevac. Great mission. You know, there are just a few things in the Army when there's not an active war going on. There are just a few of the functions in the Army that actually have a real job. The infantry's not practice, you know, they just do practice training.
Field maneuvers the whole time.
Yeah, and the artillery, they just do practice. But if you're in military police or if you work in finance or in the hospitals or in medevac, those, your functions are still real life functions. And flying down at Fort Stewart in medevac was a greatly rewarding opportunity because your mission was real. You helped people that were in need of assistance. And one of the big missions we had was the Military Assistance to Safety and Traffic Program that the Army did at that time, where we transported neonatal infants and critically injured people from all over southern Georgia and northern Florida to definitive care centers. And of course, we had the active duty mission right there at Fort Stewart, which was a pretty interesting mission by itself. And from there, I came back to the Kentucky. Well, from there, I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and finished my degree in professional aeronautics. And then I came back to Kentucky, went to work full-time for the Guard, but not in the aviation field. I went to work as a shop foreman over at Lexington in a field artillery battalion. Did that for a few years, went through their officer candidate program, and elected to not take my commission because I was working full-time for the Guard in a position where I wasn't allowed to take the commission unless I quit my job. And having a family, I didn't want to quit my job. And then I got too old to accept it. from there, I left and went to the Department of Education. But I continued my flying career, got back in the aviation side of the house and continued my flying career. Performed functions with Kentucky Guard as the standardization instructor pilot, instructing the instructors. Kind of ran that program for a while when several of the full-time people weren't available to be there because they were in other training programs. And later finished up my career as the Aviation Brigade Safety Officer of the 35th Aviation Brigade.
You've just hopped all over then.
I did a lot of different things in the military. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I grew up an Army brat, so yeah.
Oh, an Army brat.
Yeah. But one thing that we were talking about, and for the recording, he brought in a poster. He was literally a poster boy for the National Guard here in Kentucky. You talked about how, you know, you came back and was the recruiter, you know, at 19, which is very young. Now they have the hometown recruiter program, but you want to go ahead and expound upon that a little?
That was kind of a neat experience because I was, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned it a minute ago, I was the first guy that went through the Warrant Officer Candidate Program to the Army, and the second fellow that did behind me is a guy named Abe Adams. Mr. Adams, who I think is currently flying for the UPS folks down at Louisville, but he spent most of his career as the head pilot for the Kentucky State Police, and Abe and I have been friends for many years. But helicopters were new to Kentucky. I mean, the helicopter program was pretty new, and the Huey helicopters, the turbine engine helicopters, were just showing up. When I first got back from flight school, there were five or six people out of the about nearly 100 aviators that had instrument tickets, and I was one of them. And then shortly thereafter, they developed a program to train all of those other pilots to get their instrument tickets. So that was kind of unique. But I think it's important, you know, to note that there was really nothing other than just being young and able to do these things. You know, I was at least smart enough to be able to pass those tests and what have you. That's kind of neat, I guess. But there was nothing really unique about my career. I mean, I didn't really actually, you know, the war I fought in was the Cold War. All of my career was during the Cold War times. So many of the guys I flew with were really, truly heroes. One of the guys that was the undergraduate of my class, Tony Del Pozo, we graduated in November of 72, and in January of 73, Henry Kissinger, on the 27th of January, signed the final ceasefire. Okay? On the 28th, Tony got killed. And died actually on the 29th. Well, he was shot on the 28th and actually died on the 29th. Tony's a hero. You know, many of the guys that I flew with were heroes, and I wasn't. I did my job, and I really, really enjoyed what the military offered for me. And I, but I think that's true of most military people. You know, you just do what you're supposed to do. But I wasn't a hero. I've worked and served with a lot of cool guys that were heroes.
Yeah, well, that is true, though. As you said, unless you are part of a specific unit or anything like that, you just work the entire time, and, you know, that's what happens.
Yes.
But you were in a very specific, you know, place to be working, even while, you know, most of the Army and the National Guard was on stand down. You were a medevac in that. You want to go ahead and talk about the program there, about working in Georgia and Florida?
It was kind of interesting in that when I got there in, let me see, this would have been January of 77, I guess. Yeah, I suppose it was January of 77. The 24th Infantry Division was just being formed. Mm-hmm. So there were only about 5,000 people there on the post. And the mission hadn't fully developed at that time. And what's interesting about that is we provided 24 hours a day medevac 365 days a year, and we were authorized 15 pilots, and we had eight. So we worked 24 hours on call, 24 hours on duty, and then 24 hours off, and it was just on and on and on, except that I was the maintenance officer and the test pilot. So on the 24 hours I had off, I wound up doing test flying and maintenance operations. So oddly enough, I actually have officer efficiency evaluation reports that said I worked 100 to 120 hours a week sometimes. And as they were growing that division, you know, we just lived there. We basically just lived there all the time. And it was kind of an interesting time. And the first of the 75th Ranger Battalion, of which there were two at that time, the one there and one of the battalions in Fort Lewis, Washington, real elite force. They were always doing real elite training, and we were always involved with backing them up with medevac, because when you train at that level, there are oftentimes injuries and fatalities and people injured. And we flew, I cannot remember, unless the weather was just so pathetic you just couldn't fly. We just never turned down missions in our, you know, we flew all over Southeast Georgia. And we took these missions when we probably should not have taken these missions. It would be, the weather would be too bad to even fly an instrument approach into some location. So in the Army, when the weather requirements might be 800 feet for a VOR approach somewhere, you could fly night VFR if the weather was 500 feet elevation off the ground and a mile visibility, because it's flat terrain. And we would fly VFR to go pick up people when we couldn't even fly IFR in there to get them. And then from, we'd refuel and then fly back to someplace like Savannah or Augusta or someplace that had definitive instrument landing programs where we could get back in. And I remember flying at night down following railroad tracks and just, you know, with the overcast and rain, and just having to look slightly left or right to pick up just a glint of the reflection off the tracks, just 300 feet off the ground at night in terrible weather and stuff like that. And it was make the hair stand on the back of your neck. But it was always a feeling of elation when you could get one of those missions done. And many, many times we saved a lot of people. I don't know. Pretty interesting. There were some tragic things that happened there on the post. I remember we had a an F-4. The pilots, I guess they got a little target fixation, had a problem. Anyway, they punched out in the middle of the impact area. We had to pick them up one time. And, of course, there's unexploded rounds and stuff out there. And that was kind of an exciting mission. And had a guy that was run over by a tank who was still alive. We just smashed him in the sand, but that was kind of a messy, messy mission. But he was alive when we picked him up. I don't think he ultimately made it. That Ranger Battalion had a couple of guys get their parachutes tied together on a big jump they did one night. And, you know, one of them was killed instantly and the other one survived, but I think he ultimately died too. But our missions were real. They were real time and real life, and we had a very active mission there at Fort Stewart. And as the division grew, by the time I left, there were probably 30,000 people there three years later. So there was a lot of activity going on. One of the, I remember we did a big 750-man airdrop, which is a huge insertion by parachute. And I remember covering that mission. And the last couple of C-130s that went in, we were a mile and a half or 2 miles away. And you could see that they jumped out too early. And we went on and started firing up our helicopters. We hauled seven or eight medevac loads of guys that had been in trees. And it was nighttime. So they let theirself down with being too high off the ground, broken legs and arms. And our mission was the real mission, but it wasn't combat.
but it was still incredibly important.
Yes.
For the sake of the recording, though, VFR, you mind?
Oh, VFR, visual flight rules. IFR, instrument flight rules. When you fly an airline, you know, in the clouds, they're operating under instrument flight rules, and there are radio beacons and stuff on the ground that they have to navigate to, and they use those beacons to shoot approaches to the actual airfields. Well, sometimes they have minimum descent altitudes that you can shoot those approaches, and that's what I was talking about, the weather being so bad that it would be below the minimums, mm-hmm. but yet we were allowed to fly visual rules when the civilian population isn't allowed to do this, but the military population is. And we would fly visual flight rules into places that we could not otherwise have gone. And if it was a soldier on post that was hurt, the weather would have had to be absolutely unbelievable for us to not go. We would hover down the roads if we had to go try to pick them up. So night or day, didn't matter.
I can understand that one. What is kind of odd is that you didn't stay in aviation the entire time. You mentioned how you got into infantry.
Well, I got in the artillery.
Artillery, sorry.
Because I had a really strong maintenance background when I got off active duty and had graduated from Henry Riddle, I came back to Kentucky and I needed a job. That's the way that works. So the first thing I did is I went and got back in one of the aviation units out at the Boone Center. And then I had a friend of mine was working there full time. And one of these organizational maintenance shops, the one over at Lexington, had an opening. He said, man, why don't you put your name in the hat on that? So I did, and I got the job and spent several years up there doing that. Then later came and worked at the facility here in Frankfort at the Combined Support Maintenance Shop, went through that OCS program. And interestingly, the way the military is set up on the civil service system with the Guard is you have to have compatibility. The job that you're working full-time has to be compatible with your military job. Mm-hmm. So I was also trained in the automotive maintenance side of the house through that process. And I had to be assigned to a unit that had a compatible MOS. So I was assigned as the battalion maintenance tech of the 2nd and 38th Field Artillery. And then later, I went from there to the 103rd S&S Battalion out of Harrodsburg as the maintenance warrant for the Service and Support Battalion, Company B. And then when I left full-time employment and went to work for the Department of Education, and later went to work for Jefferson County Schools. That's a whole nother crazy story. when I did that, I got back in aviation side of the house. And so I had a kind of a unique career in terms of exposure. I served in lots of the major commands in the state of Kentucky, and by, you know, being so diverse that way. And it was interesting, too, because my career starting out so young, I knew guys that were lieutenants, that Stephen Collins, for example, he was a lieutenant when I met him, and he retired a two-star general. And then because I was so young, and I went through the OCS program in the 80s, and then people that I met there that were lieutenants are now chief of staff of the Guard and one-star generals again. So I've watched two or three generations of people. When I was at Henry Riddle, one of the guys in my class knew the Wright brothers, one of my instructors. Mm-hmm. Knew the Wright brothers. So I've had this connection, secondhand connection, to the beginnings of this aviation thing back to 1903, and that's been real cool to me. You know, personally it has. The guy that taught me to fly, Hildebrand, mm-hmm. one of the very pioneers of helicopter aviation, and the old man that was my instructor, Demi Riddle, you know, he knew the Wright brothers. I don't know how much closer you get to the origin than that.
Oh, yeah, gosh, that is just right there at the beginning.
It's a neat connection. And like my friend Sandy Goins, I saw he's got a little display out here, you know, Vietnam War hero. You know, he's I think he had about 48 air medals, and he's a Silver Star guy. And I was connected to a lot of really cool people.
Oh, for saying that you're not a hero, you still have had a rather distinguished career.
I've had a fun career.
One thing that I found out through Sarah was that you ended up flying Governor Ford.
Yes.
In 72, I believe?
74.
74, okay. Mm-hmm. It was a post-tornado.
April 3, 1974, we had 18 tornadoes touch down in Kentucky. A tremendous weather front came through, and it was really, really ugly. 30-some people were killed in Brandenburg, 4 people killed right here in Franklin County, and devastation from Somerset to Bardstown to E-Town to just all over Kentucky, Louisville. Really an amazing weather event moved through the state. And it went about a mile and a half from my mother's house, and I was standing in the basement and watched it, and left people, I know they don't even believe this, but they left, it dropped hailstones bigger than softballs. Mm-hmm. I hate to say big as a honeydew melon because they weren't that big, but they were bigger than softballs. And it was just unbelievable. But I was standing there, watched the tornado go by, and as soon as it did, I knew how, you know, substantial it was. And so I went straight, put on a flight suit, went to the Boone Center, and for the next couple of weeks, I flew Wendell Ford around all over the state of Kentucky, visiting these sites and him visiting with authorities at different locations, you know, to try to render assistance. And people don't realize that the National Guard as a state militia has a real primary role in helping with state issues like that, floods, tornadoes, earthquakes, those kinds of things. And it's a great mission. It's a real humanitarian mission. And it's the one of the pulse things that goes on with the Guard that the federal side of the house doesn't always seem to understand in the depth it needs to. But flew Governor Ford around, and sent a funny little story, side story about that is a few years later when he was Senator Ford, I don't remember the exact occasion, but I had to fly him to Louisville for some mission, and as we were flying along, he had an intercom set on, and so I asked him, I said, Senator, I said, you probably don't remember, I said, but back when the tornadoes came through, I flew you around. And of course, now I had my name on the back of my helmet,
yeah.
And he goes, ah, Pinks, did I remember that? Because I know he read my name on my helmet. But I'm sure that he did remember, because we did fly him around for 2 weeks, or right at 2 weeks, and then I asked him, I said, what, when you think back on that, what is the thing that sticks out in your mind the most, is one of the most devastating things? And he paused for a minute, and he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, I remember we were flying over Bardstown, and I looked down, and I believe it's the Salt River, and there were probably 1,000 whiskey barrels floating in the water. And he said, I looked down there, and it just broke my heart seeing all those tax dollars get away. And I laughed, and that was a fun little experience with the governor. He was a very nice man, and easy man to fly with and fly for.
Did you often get pulled in to do those sort of things?
Yes. That's one of the missions of the National Guard. Mm-hmm. We're, you know, we are the governor's army,
mm-hmm.
and as such, we do those kinds of things. Now, later on in my career, you know, he had his own helicopter. Good friend of mine, Logan Waller, was one of his pilots. Jim Carey, they were the two guys that were flying the governor when he crashed over here in Wadi that time when the tail rotor came off. But prior to them having their own aviation helicopter assets, it was just part of the mission of the Guard to fly them around. It wasn't me necessarily every time, but of the approximately 100 aviators we had there, if you came in for a training mission, that might be your mission that day, to fly the governor or other state dignitaries. Mm-hmm. And it was always a good mission, you know. It kept us in touch with the people that we support.
Were there a lot of, I guess you could say, humanitarian missions then during your time there? I mean, you said come in for training sometimes, but were there any other big ones like the tornado that you can remember?
There were floods, the truck strike. Back, I don't remember the exact year that was. It may have been like 74, where a bunch of the independent truckers went on strike across the country, across the United States, and it was kind of an ugly time. Fuel prices were out the roof. You know, we think fuel prices are crazy now. They were back then too. And when that was going on, a large number of us as aviators were activated, and we flew up and down the interstates, kind of monitoring the highways, and we were working closely with the state police. There's always been a very strong, because we're the governor's army, the governor's state police, you know, there's a strong bond between the National Guard and the state police. Matter of fact, a lot of the guys in the state police are also in the National Guard, and so there's a pretty big overlap there. But we flew state troopers all up and down the interstate to try to help, you know, from snipers and crazy things that were going on at the time. Another one of the missions that we do here in Kentucky that I did quite a bit of was drug interdiction. The state has a whole section of guys assigned full-time that search for drugs, and we fly all over eastern Kentucky and southern Kentucky, well, all over Kentucky, but southeastern Kentucky seems to be one of the most densely used areas for growing marijuana and stuff. And I think there are like 17 state, local, and federal agencies involved. You've got the ATF and the DEA and local sheriffs and local police and state police and just FBI, National Guard, active duty. You know, Army guys actually help participate from Fort Campbell. So it's a big mission that the state does. And that was a very fun mission. But, you know, you're out there flying around low level searching for pot or drug activity. And it's not a full-time year-round mission, but several, you know, it starts early in the spring and goes way into the fall when they harvest. And it's a big mission in the state. It's kind of been put on the back shelf a little bit with all of our guys being activated.
And sent off, yeah.
Yeah, in Afghanistan and Iraq and what have you. And it's really been taxing on the Kentucky Guard and taxing on their families. One of the things I think is real important for people to understand is being an Army aviator in the Kentucky Guard or in the National Guard of Reserves, you have the exact same annual requirements that a guy on active duty has. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a minimum of 110 hours a year, and an OH-58 when I was flying, that was the minimum. You had to fly that many hours, so much night, so much instrument training, so much everything. You have the exact same physicals to pass. You have the exact same exams that you have to pass. So you're not a part-time career. Mm-hmm. It winds up that you are actually what I like to refer to as a dual career person. You're doing whatever you do in your civilian life as a full-time job, and yet you're meeting all the requirements of a full-time job in the National Guard as well. I was getting more flight time in the Kentucky Guard than almost all of the guys I graduated with that were on active duty. My last year in the Guard, I was paid for 139 days of active duty.
Whew.
Yeah, my last year. I flew 289 hours when the minimum for the active Army was 110.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a secondary job. It's another full-time job. It's like having two full-time jobs. And even though you're not doing it 5 days a week, in my case, I was training night vision goggles and stuff like that. So sometimes I would be up at 2 o'clock in the morning meeting guys to go fly and get all that done, and then I'd be at work in Louisville at 6.
Ooh.
You know, or the flip side of the coin, you come in on a Tuesday night or a Friday night and do the same thing, fly till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning doing training, missions, different kinds of training, keeping updates and what have you. And then work, you know, a full-time job too. So, yeah, it's a really a dual career deal. It's not a part-time job.
No, that wouldn't be.
No, it's not like just delivering Domino's pizzas at night or something.
Oh, it would have been nice to have those hours, though, I'm guessing. Yes. Sometimes. You were a test pilot. Something that's very interesting to me. You did that while you were in Georgia, but did you do it here as well, or how'd that work?
Yes, I went through the Army's maintenance test pilot program in 74, I believe. And, you know, I did, you know, test flew airplanes. The actual unit that I was in was the 2113th Transportation Aviation Maintenance Company. And that's what we were, was a maintenance company. We did direct support and some limited general support. Direct support, everyday maintenance, checking the oil and things like that. It's called organizational maintenance. Mm-hmm. Direct support's the next level, where you would do engine transmission replacements, and general support's where you might rebuild some subcomponents. And then depots, when they take them and send them off, to have them rebuilt like new. And the unit I was in was a general direct support maintenance activity that had some limited general support capability. And so, yeah, that's what we did. You know, we would repair them and fix them and test fly them. Mm-hmm. And then when I was on active duty in the instructor pilot course for OH-58s, I actually got to do a little research and development test flying for development of some of the night vision goggle things they're doing today. Mm-hmm. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, that would be kind of neat. Excuse me. I need to... Oh, thank you. Left that out for you. You just have really jumped all around.
I know.
You obviously were helicopters for the vast majority of that, but what kind of planes were you working on?
I never got an airplane license, although my roommate in college, he and I were on active duty together at Fort Stewart, and he owned a J3 Cub. I probably shouldn't even say this on tape, but I will. He owned a little J3 Cub, and they're kind of unique little airplanes. They only weigh 825 pounds, and they'll take off somewhere around 30 to 35 miles an hour, they'll actually fly.
That doesn't take much.
No, wow. And wide open if you've got a headwind, the cars are passing you on the interstate. You know? But my friend owned this J3 Cub, and he and I flew it all over southeast Georgia. And he, it's an interesting little story. He bought this airplane when he was 16 years old, and he crashed it and survived the crash, obviously. And then later bought it back after another guy had restored it, same exact airplane. And it was at a location just south of Fort Benning, Georgia, and we went and picked that thing up. And it doesn't have an electrical system at all. Mm-hmm. The gas tank sits in front of the pilot, and the fuel gauge for the gas tank is really nothing but a clothes hanger with a cork and a little red line painted on it. When it gets down to the red line, you need to land. So this thing it's not instrument equipped, and we picked that thing up on an IFR day, instrument flight rule day, and flew it to Savannah because we knew the weather in Savannah was good. Mm-hmm. And we flew this thing in the clouds to south of Macon, Georgia, taking it back to Fort Stewart. But then when we were both at Embry-Riddle and roommates, we pulled signs up and down the beach, and I've flown his little airplane a bunch, but I never actually had a license for airplanes. It was kind of fun, though.
Well, yeah.
We were young. There's an old saying, you know, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots. And it was back in my bold days.
Now in the older days, perhaps not so much.
Yeah, the older days, we backed off the bold a little.
Oh. The poster here, how'd you become the poster boy for that? Did you just happen to be in the right place? Or?
I just was right place at the right time. You know, it was one of those deals where I was real unique in that I was so young. Mm-hmm. And the little news release they did, you know, they were going to say that I was the youngest guy to ever graduate. And I said, dudes, I don't think you better say that because I cannot absolutely confirm that. I know another guy I used to fly with, Barry Sipple. He was about 19 when he graduated, too. He's a Vietnam guy. He graduated straight out, went straight to Vietnam, flew with the CAV, first CAV division over there. Real cool guy. Flew doing all kinds of things in the civilian world. Fun guy. But I may have been the youngest, and I mm-hmm. certainly would have been in the top four or five of the youngest, but I may actually have been the youngest. I just never did track it down and find that out for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's all that meaningful.
Makes an interesting story.
It is an interesting story, and it was a really interesting time, and it was very, very fun being a celebrity for the Kentucky Guard and traveling around and having the opportunity to do quite a bit of public speaking, you know, telling my little story, you know, that you too could be a helicopter pilot if you can qualify yourself. It's aviation is one of those hand-me-down kind of things, you know. You want to always reach down to the new guys and help pick them up, mm-hmm. help them be better, help them learn more. And it's real unique, and I'm not sure how unique, but it's a real hand-me-down kind of a experience, you know, because there is no substitute for experience. I don't care how good you are. Mm-hmm. The guy that has the gray hair has seen and done, and as you lose your physical skills, by that I mean your reaction times and stuff like that, mm-hmm. You make up for it by the experience factor, by knowing in advance what to expect and not being upset when things go wrong. And when you're young, you have the quickness and the agility and the eyes to be able to see and do and hear, but you don't have the experience. Mm-hmm. As you get older and you lose those things, experience covers you. And if I had the option, I'll take the experience every time.
I understand.
That's why you want to fly with guys like Sully that landed in the Hudson River. He was, do you notice he was an old guy?
Yeah, yeah. He just retired. So.
Yes, he did.
I'll take the pilot with experience.
There's another thing that's real unique about being an Army helicopter pilot like that. I don't know what the exact number today is, but in the entire United States Army, there are only about 5,500 approximate aviators at any one time on, you know, and that's Guard, Reserve, that's everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's a real small little group of people. And so you know everybody. And you don't know all 5,500 of them, but if you don't know them directly, in a 5-minute conversation, you will know someone they know, mm-hmm. and you will make an immediate connect. And it's a very much of a bond between that little group of guys. And if you stop and calculate it out, there's 300 million people in the country. And if there's only 5,500 of those guys, you're like 0.000001. of a percent mm-hmm. of the population that ever even gets to do something like this. It's really a unique little deal. And then, you know, a lot of people fly, but flying military aircraft's a whole different animal. It's because the rules are different. You're allowed, not only allowed, but expected to do things that you're not allowed or expected to do in the civilian world. Mm-hmm. Not within the regulations, anyway.
Not without getting fired from your job.
Or getting killed.
Yeah. You chose to end up being a warrant officer in all of that. You know, a lot of people go from being enlisted to warrants instead of going and being a straight-up lieutenant or anything like that. Why did you make the decision?
Well, it was interesting. When I went through their officer, I was already a CW3 mm-hmm. When I went through the officer candidate program, and I worked still full-time for the Guard. And the job that I had, remember I was telling you about that compatibility thing a while ago? Some jobs are allowed to be enlisted only. Some are warrant officer only. Mm-hmm. Some are officer only. Some are all three. Just mm-hmm. they're really uniquely set up. And the job I was in only allowed me to be a warrant officer at the time. So I was 32 years old, or about to be. 32 and a half was the maximum age they'll let you get your commission.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out of OCS, I had about 8 months before I had to take it or turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me. And as it turned out, my time just ran out before I could swap jobs. But it was disheartening enough to me that I left full-time employment with them and went to work for the Department of Education, because I was really, really wanted to do that, and it just didn't work out, you know. And I could have at any time quit my job,
yeah,
and taken the commission.
Family.
Yeah, but I had a child and a wife and those kind of things, and so there I was, rocking a hard spot. And, you know, sometimes life deals you those cards. But financially, it worked out 4 or 5-fold better for me when I swapped. So it was a good deal.
Yeah.
And it allowed me to get back into aviation. At that time, I wasn't in the aviation side of the house.
Do what you love, even if you have to finagle.
You know, I consider myself so lucky because of what you just said. From early childhood, I knew I wanted to do this Army military aviation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it was going to be Army, Air Force, Marines, or what, but I knew I was going to do something in Army military aviation. And I recommend for every human being in life to find out what they love and do what you love. And I was able to do that and do so many other things too. You know, I wasn't restricted to just that,
mm-hmm.
But I was able to do my passion first, and that's so important. I think it is, anyway.
Yeah.
So important to me.
You mentioned family. One thing that, you know, people always say is, you know, if the military, doesn't matter what branch, wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one. I've heard that many, many times growing up like that. But has your family enjoyed the experience of you being? Or is that something you...
probably yes and no. I was married once before, so I'm sure the military didn't contribute to the longevity of that relationship. But in, you know, my child, I think she was excited to know that I'm down here at the History Museum telling about my story, which, as insignificant as I think it really is, it does play into the big picture, and she thinks that's pretty cool. And I, you know, I was talking earlier about getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I only missed one. You know, my child's like everybody else's child. You do the horseback riding, you do the softball and the basketball and the dance classes and all the little things you do with little girls.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of those years, I only missed one of those significant events. By that, I'm saying like where it was the dance recital. I missed a ball game or stuff.
You're a alone. Very lucky man.
But I made a really conscious effort to do that. But I did that by being up at 2 o'clock in the morning while they were in bed asleep flying, or flying till, you know, on a Friday night till 2 o'clock the next morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things like that. And I look back now and I think to myself, how did it detract? I was at the events. We still all went out and ate together as a family. We did lots of things together, but how many times was I falling asleep in my soup? Was I actively engaged, or was I more cross than I would have been if I'd have been more rested?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so now there are definitely family sacrifices, and they pale in comparison to the sacrifices that are going on today with these guys that are citizen soldiers, like the little poster says, that are in Afghanistan. You know, I've got a little, that's a piece of parachute cord made into mm-hmm. a combat bracelet, and when this most recent thing happened, when they all piled up and went to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Kentucky Guard got activated, I put that on. And until they all come home, I don't plan on taking it off. Just, they're my friends.
Yeah.
I was going to think, one of the things I was going to mention to Sarah is every quarter we have a retired aviation breakfast at the Boone National Guard Center.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of these old retired codgers that show up. We just had one last month, And I say it's supposed to be every quarter, but it's not like exactly every 90 days. You know, yeah. It's three or four times a year we get together. And Colonel Tom Barrier is the guy that has been organizing that.
Mm-hmm.
Dear friend of mine. He's one of those guys I knew as a young lieutenant, too. It's really been cool. And if you wanted to, I was thinking about telling Sarah, you need to bring this whole little operation out right out there and just set up. Or at least have someone out there to coordinate getting some of them to come down here.
No kidding.
Because there are some really cool guys.
I will definitely pass that on to her.
She needs to check into that. What I need to do is just get her email address. I have it. And next time that goes on, see if I can't get Tom to invite her to come out. And you can have a whole line of guys come down here.
Have them just line up at the door for us. That would be good.
Make them keep it clean. That's all I'd say.
Oh, but we want their pure stories. We don't want to censor
There are some.
But I want to end this interview on a high note. Any stories that you just really have been itching to tell somebody or your favorite one to tell?
Nothing just really jumps out at me. I'm not a real high-time aviator because I spent several years not flying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm gonna say about 2,500 hours. But you know what's interesting about that? I can stop and think back, and I can almost, not literally, but something close to literally, remember every hour of it. It was that exciting to me. And the friendships that you establish, and you don't even see these people. One of the guys I graduated with in flight school, his name's John Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Vietnam, came back, went to work for Bell Helicopter, was the first guy, him and another guy, first crew that flew a helicopter around the world.
Ooh.
You can look him up on the internet, John Williams, cool guy. And other than his hair's white today, looks just exactly like he did back then, a little heavier. But, you know, it's hard to imagine that I'm in an age bracket where he was the first guy to fly around the world in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about that being in the early 1900s. Well, all of it wasn't.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. But no one special thing. You know, there were some times that really make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I remember flying through a thunderstorm, actually being radar vectored between two thunderstorms south of Augusta one night about 3 o'clock in the morning. And when thunderstorms move forward, they leave trailing winds on the right and left of the direction that they're moving at about a 45-degree angle that are linear to the ground. And they can be tornado-force winds. You know, it's the same as wingtip vortices on a jet as it lands. It has huge winds that come off the tips of the wings. And the thunderstorm does the same thing. We got radar vectored between two fairly significant storms and got in some turbulence that I really didn't think we were getting on the other side of it. It probably was only a, you know, it's like I spent a year there in 2 minutes. And the helicopter was just completely out of control. We had just dropped off a patient there at Augusta University Hospital, and the worst turbulence I was ever in. The instruments were just completely out of control, and the helicopter stood straight up on its nose, and it stood straight up on its tail, and just almost went upside down a couple of times, and then all of a sudden we burst out the other side. It was calm. That was a very good feeling.
I'm sure.
Flying down into Lonica, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
In support of the Mountain Ranger training that the Army does.
Mm-hmm.
Great place to fly. Wonderful mission. Greatest people you'll ever work for is with some of the elite forces of the military, the Delta Force, the Rangers, and those kind of guys. And some of the missions we flew there, you know, those guys are out doing hardcore training. They get hurt in the middle of the night. You wind up doing hoist missions in the night, in the rain and fog and stuff like that, and then trying to fly them down to Atlanta to a definitive care center. Some of that was pretty cool.
Man, I'm sure you got to meet a whole bunch of interesting people at the time, too.
One of the guys I flew with in the Guard when I first came back from flight school, his name is Robert Francis Delano Curtis. He retired a colonel from the Marines. He was going to UK, graduated, and he got accepted into the UK law school. And he was a warrant officer, W-2, and decided rather than go to law school, he was going to go to the Marine Corps, go through their OCS program and their flight school. And I think that he set the highest standards that they have ever recorded for going through their flight school and jets down in Pensacola, Florida, if I'm not mistaken. But he already had 3,000 hours in Army helicopters. But while I was flying in Delonica, he's flying for the Marine Corps now, and they had a group of their guys down there cross training. Remember, I was talking about being that small little group of people, and you know, this big Jolly Green Giant CH-53 helicopter lands there one afternoon. I said, "Hey, I said, any of you guys know Bob Curtis?" They go, "Yeah, he's going to be here tomorrow." So we tore the bar up that night. Yeah, it was good stuff. Military career was a lot of fun. Really, really a lot of fun. Serving in the Kentucky Guard was a lot of fun. The mission for Kentuckians is a very viable mission. And, you know, there are estimated 4 million people that live in Kentucky. And I know we don't touch all of them. Mm-hmm. But the ones that get touched when their house is washed away in a flood or they need help and the Kentucky Guard's there, they never forget it. I promise you that. Last year, the big ice storm, Kentucky Guard was everywhere. 78, the big snowstorm, Kentucky Guard was everywhere. Hospitals and emergency services can't hardly keep going without their assistance sometimes. So that's one of the lovely parts of the mission that we do, and one of the fun things in the career. You know, knew a lot of people, got to do a lot of cool things, got to travel the country. You know, I flew helicopters all over the Southeast United States, man. I mean, and as a young fella, you know, I mean, things like landing at the Houston Marriott downtown at their little helipad right next to the Astrodome, you know. Mm-hmm. Get my bags, boy. I'll be inside. Silly stuff, but fun stuff. Great career. Great bunch of guys.
Good. Well, thank you for your time, and also thank you for your service.
Hey, thank you, Alicia.
Oh, you are very welcome. All right.